The Tom Woods Show, episode 2229.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. We are back once again with Gary Richide and Charlie Westerman, authors of A Twisted History of the United States, 1450 to 1945. I want to spend a little time looking at two presidents in American history, one far better known than the other. And because he's far better known, that always means he's terrible. So I have in mind Woodrow Wilson. And I should say, again, for people who don't live in the United States, or because we do have maybe 20% of the audience outside the United States, I don't expect you to know all these names. But Woodrow Wilson, you probably know because he was the president during World War I, but we're talking elected in 1912 and reelected in 1916. The other president I want to talk about came before him, and that's Grover Cleveland, who served non-consecutive terms, so elected 1884, reelected again 1892. So, gentlemen, let's dig in. I get a lot of libertarians who have Grover Cleveland on their short lists of the decent presidents. Can you make the case for why that should be, if indeed that is your opinion?
As much as Woodrow Wilson is the worst, I think to contrast with him, Grover Cleveland is the best U.S. president in American history. There are a lot of reasons for that, especially if you have this libertarian or freedom-loving penchant to see that there's actually a possibility for leaders. We're not going to say necessarily governmental leaders all the time, but in this case, he was a governmental leader serving as mayor of Buffalo, New York, and then governor of New York, and then ascending to the presidency in the Gilded Age. But he had a sense that, and it wasn't just rhetoric, he believed the more limited government, especially at the national level, that every institution, including those within the federal government, but also the states, could limit the government, the power of the national government, the better off the American people would be. A particular instance that I like to draw out about Cleveland was that, amazingly, after his first term, he ran surpluses. We might remember that, for those of us who are old enough, Charlie, you're not, but at the end of the Clinton presidency, there was all this hoopla in the 1990s and early 2000s about how the Clinton administration had left the country with a surplus. But of course, that didn't take into account further expenditure and obligations, which measured into the trillions when you think about them. But these were real surpluses. And in part, it was because Cleveland was so adamant, just absolutely adamant about the notion that government could not solve individuals, groups, states, regions' problems. The most famous episode, and Robert Higgs, the great economist, brings this up, is the Texas drought and the seed bill. Texas experienced a number of droughts in the early 1880s. There was a big push. In fact, there were bills that were passed by the House and Senate to at least provide tens of thousands of dollars from the national coffers to pay for seed for Texas farmers. And he vetoed the bill. And he vetoed the bill based on the notion that, again, the national government is supposed to function not in the special interests, but for the general welfare of the country. And to provide such welfare, what he deemed as terribly unconstitutional. And at the same time, though, he didn't just leave the Texans hanging. He just encouraged private charitable contributions to help the farmers. And sure enough, the private charitable contributions went in at numbers far exceeding, exponentially exceeding those that were designated by the government. Also, Tom, I think I love him because Lysander Spooner got into a sort of correspondence with him. And Spooner was, of course, the great libertarian American of the 19th century, at least in my mind. And he would really go after Cleveland for his speeches about what the government could do. And yet we're living in an age, the Gilded Age, in which the debate is over just how minuscule to non-existent the government ought to be. If only we could go back there, right?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. If only we could have that conversation. So Cleveland, without a doubt, belongs on, what would you say, like the top five?
I'd say top one.
Really?
I think he's the best. He is the Jeffersonian of the 19th century. I think the timeliness of his administrations were key because, and one of the reasons I suspect progressives tend to dismiss, indeed often hate Cleveland and see his administrations, I see in general textbooks, they describe the era as an era of political paralysis. Because, of course, the presidents and the administrations and the congresses that do more are always better. But he was, in many ways, proof that Americans could be prosperous, that government could function in the ways in which perhaps the framers intended for the government to function in the aftermath of the Constitution, and that he could do it in an age. You know, the progressive argument, even lending into the 20th century, was that, and this was a Theodore Roosevelt-ism all the time, was that the Constitution is sort of outdated. It's anachronistic. It's antiquated and arcane. We need something. We need elasticity, that favorite word of so many progressives. But what Cleveland showed is that, well, in the modern era of planes, trains, and, well, eventually planes, but certainly developing automobiles and trains and locomotion and major communication systems, the telegraph, and all of those incredible innovations that led to incredible economic growth, the Constitution worked just fine. It, in fact, worked for the benefit of the people and, for the most part, the Union, as it ended up being.
I want to talk about a couple of bad presidents for a minute. But before we do that, Charlie, let me bring you in here for a minute. You're actually a member of my of the Tom Woods School of Life program, which I'm very proud of. So can you just say a quick word about your experiences in that? Because this is the best thing I've ever done. It started off as I'm going to have presentations on urgently necessary things that will help our people know, you know, what to do with their money and how to get their kids educated and relocate on a budget and do all these practical things that we need to do, how to be a better public speaker, better writer, just make you a better, more skilled person and to solve a lot of the insecurities that we have living in a hostile world. But it's become so much more than that because of the accountability groups in there that are helping people reach their goals that they might not reach without the benefit of a group that keeps them on their toes and that's cheering them on. So if you could just take a brief minute to say a word about that, I would be grateful.
Yeah, the presentations have been great, but the real gold from the Tom Woods School of Life was meeting and connecting with our friend and the producer of A Twisted History of the United States, Brett Hofstadt, who we call Bookmaker Brett. We would be working on this in 2024 if it weren't for Bookmaker Brett. He basically showed us how to self-publish books, how to get it on Amazon KDP, how to do all of the graphics and upload everything. So the connections that you meet through the School of Life, I think that's the real gold of it. And the people that I met at the in-person event in Orlando that are interested in the book, that want to learn more about history. And I've been really glad to be in the School of Life, not only because of the, you know, presentations, but I think the real gold was the people that you meet in there.
Yeah, there's no question about it. People have made connections. They've started projects. I have got a guy who, if he plays his cards right, a connection he made is going to make it, without a doubt, a six-figure difference for him every year. So all good things going on in there. So check it out. TomSchoolOfLife.com is the website. So, you know, looking at the early 20th century, which is dominated by Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, the astonishing thing is the way historians try to portray the differences between Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson as being deep and profound. The only difference between them really is in their styles, their personal styles. T.R. was this rugged outdoorsman, and Woodrow Wilson was the president of Princeton. That's it. That's the only difference. I mean, they both come from elite colleges, and they both want a very strong presidency. I remember my textbook struggling to think of anything different between them, and the best they could come up with was that T.R. was a trust buster, whereas Woodrow Wilson just wanted to regulate the trusts to death. Like that, oh, wow, well, that's just a major, major difference. But they're the same. I mean, come on. Yes. Are you kidding me? They both want the regulatory state. They both want the states to be weaker, the federal government to be stronger. I mean, what? And the difference with them on foreign policy is that Teddy Roosevelt thought we should have gotten into World War I sooner. That's the big difference.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. They're all imperialists. They're all advancing the cause and the gigantic growing size and the increase in size, scope, and authority of the national government to the subjugation of every other really challenging authority from the states to indeed any corporations that might indeed challenge the ultimate power of the federal government. I love, too, there's a great well-known and it's extensively used throughout the United States textbook by Kennedy Bailey and Cohen called The American Pageant. And it's so blatant sometimes the way in which they characterize the political personages they really love and those that they really hate. So there's a quote from one of the things when in Kennedy Bailey and Cohen, they're talking about how Wilson really took on the triple wall of privilege, which were the banks, tariffs, and trusts. And I'm going to paraphrase again, but they say, energetically scaling the triple wall of privilege, Woodrow Wilson treated the nation to a dazzling demonstration of true presidential leadership. And then, of course, the next chapter is on Warren Harding, and they call him not a bad man, but a slob. it's so in your face and blatant. But the thing about Wilson that I find so, well, there are so many things that are heinous, really heinous about him. His clear and outright racism, how he loved D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, had it shown in the White House. But the things that he seemed to ostensibly, or at least on the surface, would do something good, like the Underwood Tariff Bill, which he supported, the reduction of tariffs, which is great. Hey, we're going to reduce taxes on agrarian areas of the country that had to pay inordinate fees for just the purchasing of, for example, everything from buckets to plows to gin, you name it. But of course, it was an underhanded, the ultimate goal was that he wanted the reduction in the tariff, which was the main revenue source for the federal government, so that he could supplant it with the income tax. So he's so duplicitous and undermining of what was at that time, because of the popularity of the progressive movement, as you know, from 1912, Taft, Roosevelt, and Wilson are all running for the presidency, and they're all just trying to out-progressive each other, you know. But Wilson was like his political son, and FDR called him my political daddy, which is kind of creepy too. But he was very much saying one thing at times in order to gain popularity and then doing the other.
I want to add something on Wilson because this is one of my favorite tweets from the book. Quote, "The government of the United States is contending for something much greater than mere rights of property or privileges of commerce. It is contending for nothing less high and sacred than the rights of humanity, which every government honors itself in respecting and which no government is justified in resigning on behalf of those under its care and authority." Quote. I remember writing that out during COVID when all of our own overlords were dividing us into non-essential and essential, telling us we couldn't go to the gym. You know, this is what these people think of us. It's why I don't believe in like civil discourse between the statist overlords. These people don't see us as human beings. They see us as something else. They think that we are pretty much their property.
Yeah, it's no real different than the way which Wilson spoke of the inferiority of South American peoples. He openly said, we're going to teach these South American republics how to govern and how to live. But really, the way he governed, the amount of disdain and enmity he showed toward the South American peoples and Latin American peoples was really no different than what he showed to the American people.
Well, I want to say a little bit more about World War I because the domestic efforts to get the public behind the war effort were quite significant. And it's interesting to contrast it with the Spanish-American War. The Spanish-American War is declared and 1 million men show up. And that's incredible to me because there's absolutely no danger to the U.S. at all in that case. I mean, absolutely, you've got to be kidding me, right? There's none at all. Now, also, but the same thing is true of World War I. It's true. But they had to propagandize like crazy with these speeches on street corners and, you know, everywhere you look. Can imagine what the internet would have been like. It would have just been insane. No, nobody would be allowed to say anything except the dumbest propaganda. And that was what was necessary to get the public, you know, even somewhat on board for it. I mean, after the guy had just run on the platform, he kept us out of war. He just ran on that.
And FDR does the same thing, right? And that's why they're really two sides of one card, propagating the war message and always looking out for the American empire, hell or high water. But I think Wilson would have fit right in with the COVIDian regime because, after all, he arrests anybody and he brought back the Sedition Acts. I mean, imagine that. He brings back the Sedition Acts. Also, Tom, I thought you would find this interesting. I don't know if you saw this within the book, but in order to pay for the war, one of the revenue acts actually reinstituted a stamp tax.
Yeah, I mean, that is just, they must have gotten a chuckle about that.
Right? I mean, if they laughed, unfortunately, if you look at pictures of Wilson, man, when he smiles, the few times where you see him laughing in his dastardly ways, boy, his jibs. Oh, a dentist would have a field day.
I shouldn't yet jump ahead, but yet I'm going to. There was a famous essay by William Graham Sumner called The Conquest of the United States by Spain. Yes. And of course, it's about the Spanish-American War. And you look at it and you think, well, what does this mean? The United States was never conquered by Spain. But of course, what he means is the principles of the Spanish government had begun to be internalized within the American system. And some of it came about because of involvement in war, which can have transformative effects on regimes. Well, I notice you have a rather playful title in here, heading, about how the U.S. lost World War II. Now, that doesn't seem possible, right? Of course, the U.S. won World War II. But in what sense do you mean that?
Call me a curmudgeon, but I determined victory in any endeavor as the achievement of one's objectives when you start out the process or the endeavor. So if it's ping pong, I need to score more points or be the fastest person to 21 points in ping pong, and thus I'm the victor. The stated goals over and over again of the Roosevelt administration, those who were constantly pulling the United States into World War II, was simply that, again, the United States was going to be, question if this sounds familiar, to be a beacon for democracy, to be the ultimate defender for liberal democracy throughout the world. And then as the war continued to go on and be pursued, particularly in Europe, that rhetoric was picked up. It was a number of speeches, the famous Lakeshore Drive dedication of the bridge in Chicago here. It was going to be that the United States ultimately was going to be an arsenal for democracy. Well, if that's the clear and stated objective of Roosevelt himself, the aftermath of the war, as Churchill, for anyone who reads the Sinews of Peace speech in 1946, Churchill admits, essentially, we lost. We ceded control of vast amounts of global territory, not to the preservation of liberal democracy, but we changed out one totalitarian state in Nazi Germany for the continuation and strength. And in fact, we funded the Soviet Union. I shouldn't say we, but the United States government, the Roosevelt administration, funded the Soviet Union during the war to the tune of $1 billion to fight the campaigns. And then the Soviet Union emerges, conquering Eastern Europe, Stalin always giving his platitudes and assurances to Roosevelt and Truman that none of this would happen. And then 4 years after the war, the largest nation in terms of population succumbs to communism. So if the goal was and the objective was the perseverance and continuation of liberal democracy, we lost the war.
From that point of view, I agree with you, because that in a way is one of the arguments that people who are skeptical of intervention, and even in that very popular war, have made, that when the dust cleared, look at Europe again. You know, this is not the Europe that I think we thought we were fighting for, and yet there it is. All right, so go ahead.
I'm sorry, and under that tyranny, of course, we have the threat of nuclear holocaust, as we do still today, emerging because of the Soviet Union's, grapple on Eastern Europe, its emergence as a threat to the United States. Although, again, I'm sympathetic to the Rothbard quote that the Soviet Union was just Burkina Faso with a lot of nuclear weapons. But at the same time, it's been disastrous even for liberal democracy conceived in the American conception of it. I mean, from this point on, the end of World War II on, we, as many great historians and you yourself have noted, we're in this constantly perpetual emergency state where all of the governmental actions that seem to strike at our liberties, from the Patriot Act to the existence of the CIA, are allowed to persist. And the general excuse is, well, we have this crisis to solve. We have this enemy. And when the Soviet Union's not there, it's radical Islam or it's drugs. And it's all disastrous for American individual liberties and rights.
Hey, everybody, quick sponsor message. You and I are not the type of people to do what everybody else is doing without thinking about it. So we don't just throw down six figures in tuition payments without giving it some serious thought. Or if something's in a bubble, we don't invest in it. Well, with the screwed up American healthcare system, you definitely don't want to do what everybody else is doing. CrowdHealth puts your healthcare back in your hands. Cut out the middleman, save money, and fund your healthcare costs without relying on big government or big health insurance companies. You can see any doctor you want, no deductibles, exclusions, or co-pays. You pay only the first $500 of any healthcare event. The CrowdHealth community takes care of the rest. You pay one low monthly total to fund your account. Your monthly subscription helps fund healthcare costs of the entire CrowdHealth community. CrowdHealth reverses the vicious incentives that got us into this mess in the first place. It helps you find great care at a fair price, always pays doctors as quickly as possible, and actively negotiates to keep costs down for everyone. Take charge of your healthcare today with CrowdHealth. Open enrollment is the only time you can hit eject on the broken system without penalty, so don't wait. And for a limited time, join for just $99 per month for your first 6 months when you use promo code WOODS at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com, promo code WOODS. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. So how long did it take you to write this?
2 years.
Okay. Now, Gary, you've been, well, I guess you guys have been teaching in one capacity or another?
Well, after I was summarily dismissed from both institutions at which I was teaching, Tom, and I actually was just right before the pandemic hit in March of 2020, I have been working in finance, and that's allowed me to have some free time to do the writing and also contribute to a website and stuff of that nature.
Good, good, good. Yeah, I found that it was, of course, much, much easier for me to pound out that Politically Incorrect Guide to American History book because it was just, this is what I've been teaching people. So,
yes.
You know, it's right at my fingertips. It's all in my head. I've got the notes all here. So it wasn't so hard to put that thing together. And that was a huge, huge help. And likewise, you know, teaching Western Civ for the Ron Paul curriculum. Well, I've been teaching Western Civ for 7 years by that point. So that made it somewhat easier, even though those Western Civ courses are way, way more detailed than anything I ever taught. But in the course of doing this, of course, you're no doubt reading a lot of books. But in the course of teaching, you come across, I remember there used to be a representative of different textbook companies would come by once in a while and leave off, you know, examination copies to see if I wanted to adopt a particular text from my classroom. And it just, I hated all of them. I hated every single one they brought to me. And the guy just stopped coming to my office. He just thought I was unreasonable or a crank or something. But I would actually point out to him, I'd say, look at the way they treat this topic. This is unacceptable.
Oh, absolutely. I spent so many hours pouring through. My objective was to find a palatable textbook. And I finally settled on one after looking at about 10 or 12 or so. There's one by Hamalainen and Paul Johnson is a contributor that's decent to pretty good. But the standard ones that are just distributed for, a lot of times it's for the AP classes, unfortunately. So you have what we would think the elite students are, the American pageant. Oh, they're very bad. They're really bad.
Yeah. So you have no choice, in effect, but to come up with a book like this that indeed, like my Politically Incorrect Guide, is not a thorough beginning to end history of the U.S. It's necessarily selective. In my case, because they said to me, you have 80,000 words. It's not possible to write a history of the U.S. in 80,000 words. It's not. I've told the story before, but I submitted 100,000. And I thought, they're not going to actually say to me, you worked too hard on this thing, take 20,000 out. They're not actually going to say that. They did,
right. Actually.
They did say that to me. They said, you have to take 20,000 of them out.
Well, and I have an immense debt of gratitude toward you because the way I style my classes, and Charlie can attest to this, I was a Dominican seminarian. So for three years, I studied to be a Dominican priest before I left, obviously, since I have four kids and a family now. But I wanted to make my classroom into a kind of medieval disputatio seminar. And the way in which you conducted yourself in your books, particularly on the PIG, how you did very much what a Thomist would do and a scholastic, truly steel man instead of straw man opposing arguments, take them on, anticipate them even. I think you did that best with the Abel Upshur and the whole note on nullification and secession portion of the Politically Incorrect Guide. And that spirit and that enthusiasm that was clearly transferred in the book toward the readers and my students really got them into the point of history, which is constant argumentation and revision, but doing so in a way that is professional and doing so with the objective being objectivity, but understanding too that it's never going to be completely achieved.
Exactly. I don't see how it's possible to write history without some kind of perspective. I don't see how it's possible. You have to be selective in what you include, not because you're trying to exclude important things, but if history was just about things that happened, then we would include every meal everybody ate. But unless the person was poisoned by that meal, that's really not important. So even the very fact of sifting out what's important and what isn't is unavoidably affected by the point of view of the author. So for instance, somebody who is knowledgeable about economics might want to say something about the central bank's policy during a particular decade, whereas somebody who isn't won't mention that and is going to leave out a critically important part of the story. So it's unavoidable that the personality and the knowledge base and the perspective of the historian will be manifest. But what you do is do what Rothbard does at the beginning of his
Conceived in Liberty,
where he says, here's my philosophy of history. I'm just going to lay it out to you, that it's an ongoing struggle between liberty and power. And here's what I mean by these terms. And that's the kind of narrative you can expect inside this book. And everybody going into it knows that that's the story they're getting.
Right. And isn't it, conversely, isn't it wild too that, and you've commented this on several occasions in the podcast, how in the academic or in just graduate school departments, the theses are all about the minutiae instead of what is ultimately significant, consequential, and important. So you're getting theses that are accepted of, were 17th century French bourgeoisie women eating for breakfast? And no one cares. And then they're just writing to each other.
But thankfully, in this day and age, we have enough dissidents out there that they can write a book like A Twisted History of the United States and get it out to the general public through our dissident channels, like the Tom Woods Show. You know, so I feel like today, despite all the problems we suffer from and all the deplatforming and stuff, there really weren't many platforms for people with dissident views in the old days. Now, it's true, Garrett wrote for the Saturday Evening Post. I mean, that's not nothing. And he did make a bit of a splash. But today, who's heard of him other than you and me and a handful of others? You know, whereas right now, because we at least have the online real estate that we have, we are able to write, you know, as I was saying in a talk I gave recently, we're able to write revisionist accounts of things as they're happening and almost live blogging them, revisionist accounts of what's going on, based on the idea that probably we're being lied to in almost every case. What's the real story? We're able to do that in ways we weren't able to do it before, just because we have outlets and channels and decentralized networks that we didn't have in the past. And we are inclined to overlook this these days and get discouraged because of all the bad news that's out there. But we have to bear in mind, we still are in a much, much stronger position than we were in the past. Much stronger.
That's the white pill, Tom. That's a lot of the spirit of how we got this book completed during COVID in Illinois and Chicago. Cook County had some of the strictest laws in the world, I think. And, you know, Gary and I, there were a lot of long nights working on this and nights where the exterior world was a complete mess. But we figured, you know, we can at least make a difference by putting this out there and help the cause for liberty. So exactly what you just mentioned, where it's bad, but it's probably not as bad as being, we brought this example up earlier. If you were anti-war at the time of World War One, you know, how are you getting that message out? There is no way to, you know, post something on a Twitter and then, you know, gain an audience through that. Nowadays, it's a lot easier. So that spirit right there, that's a very encouraging sign for us, for people who love liberty, for people who don't want to be slaves. It's that spirit. And that's why I think that everyone should do everything that they can, whatever that is, because, you know, some people just weren't as fortunate to have this opportunity that we have now.
Well, the book is A Twisted History of the United States, 1450 to 1945. It's a lot of fun to read. It's easy to read. It's attractively laid out. It could be used for, I don't mean this as a put down, I mean this as sort of a weird compliment, could be used as bathroom reading for those of you who indulge in that.
Because you know, can I interrupt it for 1 second?
Yeah, please.
Shout out to Robbie Bernstein, the Robin to the Batman of Dave Smith. He might get mad at me for saying that, but when we did a Run Your Mouth episode with Robbie, that's exactly what he said. So I guess we're a toilet bowl.
We actually get that all the time. Yeah, we get that a ton.
Oh, isn't that funny? Isn't that funny? Because you can just read, you know, chunks here and there. And, you know, it's not like every chapter is 100 pages or whatever. You can,
right.
You know, it's divided up very nicely. So anyway, well, I hope it does well for you. And as I say, it's fun. It's libertarian. It's punchy and provocative. And probably, not probably, but possibly, you will read something in there that will offend you slightly. But that's okay because unlike our opponents, we're all grown-ups and we don't care about that stuff. So that's that. So thank you, guys. I'll have that linked on the show notes page, which today is tomwoods.com/2229. Best of luck and thanks again.
You're the best, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.